manga translated into English. Came out last year. So basically for that book, I ended up reading every manga that has been translated in English. I am also a manga reviewer for Otaku USA magazine. And before that, I worked at Viz for about 10 years. So pretty much, I've worked on a lot of manga. I've read a lot of manga. And in fact, in the last 24 hours, to meet my Otaku USA deadline, I read 20 manga. So do you see this cup of coffee? This was full half an hour ago. So you guys are in for a very interesting panel. It's just, you know, based on my, like, physical state alone, even if I didn't say anything or talk about manga at all. But I'm glad you made it, because I am going to talk about manga. I'm going to talk about how manga came to the U.S., and it's a long journey. And in fact, it's been 30 years since the first manga was translated into English for English speakers. And it's been just a little over 20 years since the first manga was really regularly translated into English by major companies. And how did it happen? Where did it all come from? What is it doing here? Like, this could be a very shocking panel. So I think first I should ask everyone who has any connection to the manga industry to leave so that you aren't offended. So that I can still get work from you after this panel is over. And secondly, anyone who is pregnant or has any heart conditions should also leave the room. And lastly, anyone who's ever read manga, so then I can just leave, and I won't have to do the panel. But, okay. All right, I'm going to do it. This is going to be like my intense training, just like in Shonen Jump. So, let us begin. All right, so this is a typical scene from today in the Borders Books in San Francisco, where I sit down every day and read manga for free. So how did this come about? I mean, obviously there were no manga sections in most bookstores 10 years ago, or a lot of bookstores didn't even have manga sections 5 years ago. Well, the history of manga in the U.S. goes back a long time to the first anime in the U.S. And to see that, we have to go back 45 years to 1963. And 1963 was a big year for American comics. That's when things like Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four were appearing for the first time. But coincidentally, it was also the year that Astro Boy appeared on American television. And Astro Boy was one of the first we made major animated TV shows in Japan, and it was also brought to America with a lot of fanfare and became really popular. But almost nobody knew that it was Japanese in origin, and almost nobody knew that it was based on a Japanese manga, of which some of the covers from the magazines are here. And some of this early hit anime, which were brought to the U.S. on TV, were also based on manga, like Kimba the White Lion and Gigantor. But the actual manga adaptation, the original manga that the things were based on, was not translated. It took more than 30 years for the Astro Boy manga to get translated. In the meantime, something that American publishers found was a lot easier would be to just completely ignore the fact that they were the original manga and have some American dude redraw it completely. Like with this Astro Boy comic here, which was not Osamu Tezuka's original Astro Boy. It was, you know, an American knockoff based on the anime. So almost no one in the U.S. was aware of the existence of manga. Possibly one of the first manga fans. Oh wait, I got this slide out of order. This is just to show you that it was, in fact, a different time back in 1966 when Kimba the White Lion was being produced. This is the exciting voice cast of Kimba the White Lion. This is about a bunch of square and white, a bunch of people as you can possibly imagine. One of the first manga fans in the U.S., also pretty square and white, all things considered, was Fred Patton. Fred Patton was originally a science fiction fan. He was, as he tells it here, he was a big fan of the show The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the early spy show. And he was hanging out at a sci-fi convention and happened to see some of the Man from U.N.C.L.E. manga adaptation. Or as it was known in Japan, 0011 Napoleon. And the manga adaptation was drawn by none other than Takao Saito, the creator of Golgo 13. So Fred Patton was really into the show, so he decided he'd actually go to some Japanese bookstores in L.A., where he tracked down the manga adaptation. Which, I mean, there was manga, you know, that was available in the U.S. that was all untranslated and sold to Japanese people living in the U.S. So Fred Patton was one of the first people to really get into this and actually, you know, actually keep an eye on it. And coincidentally, he was running a bookstore called Wonder World Books at the time, which was a import comics bookstore in L.A. And they did a lot of mail order business. And most of the stuff they were selling was European comics or like old newspaper strips and stuff. But they actually then were the first company to basically sell untranslated manga to English speakers. And they introduced the Japanese comics section and started selling stuff like Devilman. And Fred Patton also was one of the early anime fans. In the 1970s, he formed the Cartoon Fantasy Organization, which was the first anime club in America. Their mascot was a Fanta. That is a little ferret-like creature down there in the corner. Her name is Fanta. Because, in fact, Fred Patton was not only one of the first manga and anime fans in the U.S., he was also one of the first furries. You can see there that he, in fact, edited a furry anthology just in the last 5 years. The blood is still in his hands. But there was lots of crossover between furries and early anime fans. Cutie Bunny, created by Joshua Quagmire, where he sent this comic to Osamu Tezuka and Go Nagai, and he got an encouraging letter back, which he printed in the letters column. I mean, if you think about it, actually, Osamu Tezuka's work, you know, is already kind of furry-ish. Early, there's a certain similarity in the fact that, like, you know, anime was, you know, basically, a lot of the early anime was basically, like, kids' cartoons, but it was treating, like, serious themes which were more deep than they could be found in American kids' cartoons. And similarly, furries also, like, are also something which is considered, you know, like, furry animals, they're for kids. But in furry comics, they might be doing, like, adult stuff, like talking about like philosophy and religion, or like having sex, like in that Osamu Tezuka comic there on the right. So there was a certain amount of crossover. It's kind of a natural thing. But another sort of theme of manga which was developing at the time, however, was the like sort of more realistic manga, stuff like Lone Wolf and Cub, very realistic action manga. Vernon Grant was a guy living in Japan at the time, one of the first Americans to get into Lone Wolf and Cub. He did some articles about it for the Mainichi Shimbun, a Japanese newspaper. And one of the things he was really into was the way that they drew action, which was kind of a early style showing, you know, some of the stuff that people associate with manga action scenes now, like the speed lines, you know, and just the way that they show motion. And there are some other people in America who are also fans of it. There was sort of a mini martial arts boom in the U.S. at the time, and the creators of Manhunter, this comic published by DC Comics, had read some manga, stuff like Lone Wolf and Cub and Kamui, and they kind of were slightly influenced by it. Although they managed to give their ninja like the most un-ninja-like costume imaginable. And so, yeah, there was kind of an interest in, like, Asian martial arts and all that stuff at this time. And another early manga-influenced set of artists was Wendy Pini, the creator of ElfQuest, and her husband. And they were both fans of Kamui, an early ninja manga. In fact, if you look at them closely, the elves in ElfQuest kind of look like the main ninja from Kamui was elf ears. But, another early influence was in ElfQuest. And she's now doing a comic for GoKami, I believe, The Mask of the Red Death adaptation. Yeah, she's actually here at the con. Is she in the room?
No, she's in
North Valley. No, I mean, is she in the room now listening to me say this? All right, well, good. All right. Okay, so now we find ourselves in 1978. And then this is the year the first manga was translated for English speakers. And that was Barefoot Gin. So Barefoot Gin was actually translated by an anti-nuclear group as a way of educational comic to spread the word about, you know, about nuclear war. And Barefoot Gin, for those of you who haven't read it, is a really excellent manga from the early 70s, which is about the Hiroshima bombing. And it was drawn by Keiji Nakazawa, who actually was a survivor of Hiroshima. So it's basically an autobiographical comic in a way. And it's really intense and really violent and gory, with tons of scenes of like horrible, horrible deaths and mutilations and radiation sickness and like maggots crawling in people's wounds. It has a very serious anti-war message. It's a very political comic. And it's about this kid who survives the, you know, the bombing, and his half of his family dies, and you know, he's, and you know, he struggles to survive in the post-war world. So this is intensely political comic. Where did it appear in Japan? Well, it actually appeared in Shonen Jump magazine. So yeah, so I'm sure that you're all familiar with how political Shonen Jump is. I'm sure you've all read the Rape of Nanking storyline in Naruto. No, actually, it was a different time. It was a different time. There was a lot more political themed comics being published in Japan in the late 60s and early 70s. Those are some of Shonen Jumps from that time period over there on the right. Shonen Jump was a lot less political than some of the other stuff that was being published at the time, but still, yeah, this, coincidentally, the first comic, first manga translated in English was a Shonen Jump manga. Another popular comic manga from the 70s, which was not translated at the time, although later on Tokyopop translated it, was Lupin the Third, the manga about the master thief. And Monkey Punch, the creator of Lupin, was heavily influenced by American comics. He was a huge fan of Mad Magazine and the Mad Magazine style of illustration. And in fact, he was such a fan that he was really into American comic artists. And he went over to America in 1979 and visited a lot of American artists. And he wrote about it in a little three-page strip, which was published in Animage magazine. So here's a little strip of his trip to America. And so he went to San Francisco. He met up with a bunch of his favorite comic artists. You know, he met up with some underground comic artists. Then he went down to L.A. And there he is talking to like the LA Fantasy and Science Fiction Organization, telling them, "I can't English." And he had a really awesome time. And he went to the San Diego Comic-Con, in fact. And he vowed, in the last panel of the strip, he vowed, "See you again, USA." And he did come back. He did come back to the San Diego Comic-Con, and he actually brought his friends. And so 1980 was the first time that Japanese manga artists were welcomed as guests to the San Diego Comic-Con, including Monkey Punch, and also Osamu Tezuka, who died a couple years later. But at the time, he did actually come to Comic-Con and you know, was on a panel like this one, only incredibly awesome. So, I mean, this was like, you know, none of their works had been translated, but they did have fans in the U.S. at this time. But, I mean, and of course, the American comics industry was aware that there was a big market for comics in Japan. But they were not thinking, "Let us translate these comics and bring them to America." They were thinking, "How can we sell our stuff in Japan?" And so, as a result, they were producing a lot of, like, hybrids, like this Spider-Man manga, which was published in Japan in the 70s and was later actually translated into English by Marvel. Or, like, Batman manga adaptations. So they were, you know, they were thinking, how can we publish our awesome American stuff in that little backwater foreign country of Japan? But, I mean, there was also comics that were influenced by Japanese pop culture and Japanese franchises, like Godzilla comics, not manga, published by Marvel Comics. And then by the 80s, the whole idea of, like, the martial arts boom had kind of died off, and giant robots from Japan were starting to come in. So we started to see comics like Shogun Warriors from Marvel, based on Japanese toy lines. However, there were some American comic artists who were actually fans of manga, were influenced by manga, such as Frank Miller. Frank Miller was a big fan of Lone Wolf and Cub, all the way back in the early 80s. And he was actually very influenced by it. And he kind of perceived that ninja was the next big trend in America, and he sort of jumped on that bandwagon by introducing ninja and a little bit of kind of manga storytelling style into Daredevil, which he was drawing at the time. So all of a sudden, Daredevil, who originally was this dude with like horns in his head, was fighting ninja continually, and getting involved in all these these Asian martial arts influenced storylines. And so Frank Miller went on to do Ronin, which was his most Japanese influenced comic to date, which was very much a lone wolf and cub riff. And the whole ninja theme in Frank Miller's comics, which was taken from Lone Wolf and Cub, ended up getting parodied in stuff like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or like the original Tick comic. The ninja stuff didn't make it into the Tick animation or the Tick live action show. So, but if you wanted to get actual manga in the U.S. and not just like American comics that had ninja in them, it was pretty slim pickings. There was a couple like very small print run things that were published, like this magazine titled simply Manga that had like one issue in like the early 80s. And occasionally there'd be Japanese series published in magazines like Heavy Metal or Epic. And there'd be bilingual stuff, like the bilingual Urusei Yatsura there from 1983. The first shoujo manga published in the U.S. was The Rose of Versailles, a really awesome story about Marie Antoinette and cross-dressing members of the palace guard in France in the 18th century. And this was published in a very limited print-run edition. The translator was Frederick Schott, who was probably one of the biggest manga fans in the U.S. at the time, and who wrote Manga Manga, The World of Japanese Comics, which was the first book which was really basically introducing manga to American readers at the time. Still an incredibly awesome book. You should definitely check it out if you haven't already. And he basically broke it all down. He broke down the boys' manga, the girls' manga, all the like different subgenres of manga, like adult manga, the whole history, pretty much everything up to 1983 when he published it. But for most Americans, when they thought of Japanese stuff or Japanese-influenced comics, it was still stuff like Transformers, which was based on like Japanese toys and was all totally drawn in America, or other franchises like Starriers. However, around 1984, Robotech went on the air. The Robotech anime was a sort of a hybrid of three different Japanese shows, and the plot lines were heavily rewritten, but still, it was like one of the most authentically anime-ish things which had been brought over to America, which didn't disguise its Japanese origins. And it had a lot of fans, and here's some of the Robotech comics which were produced in America, but as you can see on the right, now American artists were actually trying to imitate the whole like big eyes and little mouths and the fluffy hair thing, which was already being associated with manga in the 1980s. And the whole robot thing also produced other comics in America which were giant robot influenced, like Dai Kamikaze or Dynamo Joe there. And on Dynamo Joe you can see the like tiger headed sidekick, so just to let you know the furry thing was still alive and well. But for the most part, these were all comics drawn in America, like these Speed Racer comics drawn in America, or the original Astro Boy, which is actually not the original Astro Boy. It was just done by some American dudes. But there was a little bit of manga that was being translated, like these GoGo the 13 comics, which were produced in association with the 8-bit Nintendo GoGo 13 video game, which had just come out. I distinctly remember that video game because that was the game that, as all my friends discovered, where you would like get your life points back by like talking to mysterious women in hotel rooms, and then the camera would cut away. So, 1987. We got 20 years to go. In 1987, the first manga was translated in a big edition in American comic stores. And that was Lone Wolf and Cub. Frank Miller had been talking about it for years, and finally a company got it together to actually buy the rights to the original Lone Wolf and Cub and publish it in English. And It was actually a really big hit at the time. Since then, it's been reprinted by Dark Horse. But at the time, it was published in, you know, the American, like, thin comic book format. And one of the reasons it sold so well is because it had new covers drawn by Frank Miller. So Lone Wolf and Cub was a big hit. But there was also another company that happened to start at the same time, which ended up being even more influential on the whole American manga scene. And that was Viz. And Viz, this is Seiji Horabuchi, the founder of Viz. He did a book called Moeru America, which is on the right, which is about the founding of Viz. And Seiji founded Viz together with his friend Satoru. He met Satoru, and he were basically the two people in charge of Viz for the first 20 years or so. And they met at a folk song club in a college back in Japan. So they were both kind of hippies. This is them in 2001. This is them 20 years earlier. So these are the founders of Viz. They were not the only hippies involved in the early manga industry. As a matter of fact, Seiji and Satoru were basically ended up getting this deal with Shogakukan, a publisher in Japan, that they would try to publish Shogakukan's comics in America. But they didn't really know anything about the American comics industry, so they hooked up with Eclipse Comics, which was run by Cat Ironwood and Dean Mullaney up in Northern California. And so Eclipse Comics basically was Viz's, they co-published with Viz for like a year. And they eventually went out of business as a comics publisher, but the former Eclipse office is now a magic shop run by Cat Ironwood, where you can buy various trinkets and charms and so forth. That says in the lower right-hand corner. But at the time, they were a comic publisher, and one of the people working in, I believe, the stock room or the warehouse, someplace like that, was James Hudnall. And James Hudnall was one of the early Viz rewriters and people working on the translations. And he'd been a manga and anime fan, and he actually apparently had been writing letters to Japanese publishers, trying to encourage them to break into the American market. So there's kind of a debate over whether Viz was founded because Seiji and Satoru had the idea to found Viz, or whether it was published because James Hudnall wrote letters to people in Japan telling them they should start a manga company. Anyways, James Hudnall had a roommate who was Torin Smith. Torin Smith he was introduced to manga by James, and he got so into it, he decided he would actually move to Japan and, learn Japanese and try to make a lot of contacts in the manga and anime industry. And he actually succeeded at this. He got to know the people at Gainax, for one thing, and they actually created a character with his name, Smith Torin, who was appeared in the Gunbuster animation back in 1988. So Torin Smith was also instrumental in figuring out one of the things that was really bugging the Viz people at the time, which was how would they turn manga from the tankobon, the graphic novel format, which Japanese people were used to, and how would they make it into the thin, floppy American comics format, which Americans were used to, and which was the only way that manga was sold in the U.S. for the first 10 years, almost. And what they basically came up with was the whole idea of flipping manga so that it reads from left to right, and redoing all the sound effects in English, which was pretty much the industry standard for the first 15 years. All right. So, of course, hardly anyone does this anymore, but this is how it used to be done. This is a little comic which was drawn by Tomoyuki Saito, Torin Smith's wife. And it was drawn in Dengeki Daio, a Japanese magazine. So basically this is how manga was translated. First you got some white, big-nosed, freckle-faced American who was reading a manga magazine and can't figure it out. Okay, then you've got the people who are making the offer to the Japanese publishers and the whole licensing business, and they offer the Japanese publishers money to publish their manga. But there you have the manga, and it's got Japanese sound effects, and it's in Japanese, which of course is repulsive to Americans. They cannot stand it. So the manga is flipped right to left. And this is all before digital computer technology was pretty advanced. So this was all done with photographic techniques. And then it was actually relettered by hand with a whiteout and glue sticks and other primitive tools. And presto, you get the English edition of Super Tummy Yumiko. And in the middle panel, the reader is freaking out. The Japanese reader is freaking out when he hears that it is being published in 32 pages for 300 yen, or about $3. And so yeah, even Tomoyuki Saito cannot really bring herself to like justify this. But yeah, that manga was almost all published in the American comic books format, and it was almost all published at a rate which is pretty expensive compared to manga today. Like basically about $16 for a graphic novel, or about $3 for a comic. But that's the way the manga industry was then. And so Viz basically was trying to like appeal to American comics fans. They chose the comics they thought, manga they thought would be popular in America, like Kamui, which of course had ninja in it, and the art looks just like Lone Wolf and Cub. And like My Psychic Girl by Ryuichi Ikegami, who has a kind of American art style. There on the cover, I don't know if you can read it, it says, "She is pretty. She is psychic. She is Japanese." And also Area 88, which probably looks the most quote unquote manga of all of these three, but it's still got a military theme, and you know, it looks very like 80s or 70s. So these were the first three manga that Viz did. And so by 1987, we had two manga publishers in the U.S. First Comics and Viz, who was, at the time was working with Eclipse. 1988. Alright, so here's Viz in like the first year of Viz. And about 10 people. So one of the early comics that what they were publishing at this time was Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind. It was in a dispute over Nausicaa and who would get to translate and the letter Nausicaa that Torrin Smith stopped working with Viz and founded his own company, Studio Proteus. And Studio Proteus was like a manga, they were like a manga mercenary, okay, who would basically like pick manga that Torrin Smith thought were good, and then they would like, you know, they would do the translation and the lettering and all that, and they would get another company like Eclipse Comics to publish it. And Torrin was really into science fiction manga. I mean, that was what was popular in America at the time, too. So some of his comics that he published, one of the most popular early ones was Appleseed and Other Stuff by Masamune Shiro. Dark Horse published a little manga. They published the Godzilla manga. Marvel Comics, they published what at the time was a really big popular manga, Akira. The anime was already pretty well known in the U.S. But, of course, they were Marvel Comics. So, you know, they decided they would colorize the manga. And this was actually one of the first digital coloring jobs of any kind that was done in the U.S. in the early, then way back in the early 90s, late 80s. So also, the original Speed Racer comics finally got translated. Or actually, they're all right, but the anime came first. The comics, the manga was just a spin-off.
Otaku USA Magazine proudly presents a new podcast. Fresh in Kadaba, soaked in 31 different flavors of Win.
Wow, raspberry Win!
And fired from a maser cannon of pure love.
I can feel!
This podcast will seek to deliver to you what many of its valiant readers have asked of us many times before. Bearing that in mind, what does this show actually contain, you ask? Why, the news, of course, but much, much better. Let me explain. Friday Ace, the podcast edition, is your chance to catch up on all the happenings in Japanese pop culture from this past week, including news recaps, music rankings, and all those interesting tidbits you would have known about had you not given into that burning urge to have a life. Download new episodes every Friday exclusively from otakuusamagazine.com.
Published. Another really weird thing that came out at the time was Manga Gene magazine, which ran for a couple of years. Manga Gene was basically kind of like the stuff that Manga University publishes nowadays. It was a how to learn Japanese by reading manga magazine, and it also had like articles on like Japanese culture and stuff. But this wasn't aimed at like manga or anime fans. This was aimed at like businessmen who wanted to like discover the secrets of the Japanese economy so they could make big bucks like selling to people in Japan. Because at the time in the 80s, everyone in the U.S. was really like freaked out about Japan. They thought that Japan was going to take over the world, and they were all like cyborgs, you know, and they had like the secrets of how to like be incredibly successful, little not realizing that the Japanese economy was actually about to completely tank. Whoa, and then my computer crashed, telling me I'm spending too much time on this slide. So one of the things that had also come out just a few years before was Japan Incorporated, which was a manga adaptation of a economics text, talking about like the success of the Japanese economy. You can see Ronald Reagan in manga form, very small there on the left. So at the time there was actually a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment and a fair amount of racism, like in the scene here where American auto workers are firebombing Japanese cars because they're complaining about losing their jobs. There was a certain amount of like phobia about, you know, Japanese stuff, even though it was popular. In fact, even Eclipse Comics, after Viz split off from Eclipse, they could not resist doing adolescent radioactive black belt hamsters massacre the Japanese invasion. A kind of cheap shot, I think, really. But anyways, they didn't publish too much more manga after that. So Eclipse sort of stopped publishing manga and went out of business. But there was a bunch of other manga publishers rising up, like mushrooms. There was also some of the first magazines that were devoted to anime and manga that were commercially published. Stuff. Protoculture Addicts was one. Another one was Animerica, which rose out of Animag, an earlier fan magazine. Animerica's first editor was Trish LeDoux. She previously had become famous for her role as the voice actor of the sexy alien girl, Khan, in Outlanders, the anime. And for many years, she could not live this down. Another person who was, and Animerica was published by Viz, another early Viz employee, was Carl Gustav Horn, who's now Dark Horse's primary manga guy, and who has buttons made after him. There were some other small manga publishers from the 90s, Sun Comics, which came and went really quickly. There was Blast Books that published a lot of horror and kind of guro manga. Well, not a lot, they published like three or four things in the 90s. There was Antarctic Press. Antarctic Press started out by doing manga-influenced American comics, like Ninja High School. And then they eventually went on to publish actual manga, like Sylvester here. The manga people who worked at Antarctic Press, Antarctic Press actually split off into several companies. A lot of people left them. The manga people formed a company, Studio Iron Cat. And Studio Iron Cat, they published some manga, but these were not like big superstar manga like Shonen Jump manga or something. These were pretty much like small doujinshi level manga. A lot of them were published because, you know, some personal connection to the artist or something. So they were pretty small press and had that kind of like, you know, small press feeling. They were not even, you know, some of the artists, like, you know, were very colorful, like a Pongy Bang, who was not above, like, doing sexy poses of herself on the back cover of her manga to sell her manga. And also the furry people from Antarctic Press split off and formed Radio Comics, which published furry manga and furry American comics. So the furry family tree continues down to the present day. So meanwhile, back in the like world of people who don't go into comic stores, manga was actually being published based on Japanese video games, which were getting popular. Viz did a short-lived video game manga magazine, which I was the editor of, actually. And anime was also starting to become bigger. Ghost in the Shell was the first anime to hit number one on the U.S. home video charts. And it was published by... anime was published in the U.S. by a company called Manga Entertainment, which is still around. And Manga Entertainment, although their name is manga, they actually only published anime, which led to a certain amount of confusion when you had things like manga's mascot, the Manga Man, who's actually obviously not drawn in a manga style at all, and just looks like some like cyborg from like a British issue of Judge Dredd or something. And so you had also companies like U.S. Manga Corps, who also did not publish any manga. Although later on, their parent company, CPM, formed CPM Manga Central, so they did, in fact, end up publishing some manga. But at the time, the whole idea of manga was starting to become kind of like an in thing. But people had, you know, But a lot of it was mixed in with influence from Japanese anime and video games, you know, Capcom games and so forth. And so, you know, artists like Joe Madureira were putting, you know, like speed lines and stuff into, you know, the X-Men. And the whole idea of manga was becoming very trendy, and you had books with titles like Manga She or like Manga Spawn action figures, because if it's manga, it has to have like tentacles and like it has to be a robot. And you had like the X-Men manga, which was actually a translation of Japanese X-Men comics, and you had the Marvel Mangaverse. So the whole idea of manga was suddenly known to everybody, although like actual manga sales were actually still pretty dang low. One of the early manga-influenced artists, who's still working today, was Adam Warren. He'd been doing stuff since the late 80s, and as he remembers, there was a time when, quote, editors wouldn't piss on you if you were on fire if you were working in the manga style. But now he's actually been working for the last 20 years and is doing Empower, a book for Dark Horse now. So yeah, here we are in 1996. When manga is doing all right, the American comics industry has had like a big crash in like the early 90s, but manga is still doing sort of okay. And 1997. All right, so let us travel now to Los Angeles and be introduced to a guy called Stu Levy, who founded a little company called Mix Entertainment. Mix Entertainment produced they came into the scene in 1997 with Mixzine, which was an attempt in America to do a Japanese-style manga magazine, where instead of like having like a little thin American comic-style format, you would have like several stories in one issue, like Shonen Jump magazine. They were not the first people to do that. Viz had already tried a couple of manga anthologies, like Manga Vision and Pulp here, but Manga Vision and Pulp. Their sales weren't too high, and Mixzine had something which they did not have, namely shoujo manga. Yes, Mixzine had the Sailor Moon manga. They also had Magic Knight Rayers, and both of these were pretty popular at the time, because it was the first like shoujo manga for like, you know, younger readers that had really been published in America. And shoujo manga, of course, comes from like a totally different world than boys manga. It has a very different style, you know. And for many years, people in America, publishers thought it was like pretty much unpublishable in America. But coincidentally, I mean, some of the manga which had been surprise hits in America that people didn't really think would be successful were, they were boys' manga, but they were like romantic comedies and stuff, which belonged to genres which, you know, which were not ninja or were not giant robots, and which people didn't really expect to be popular in America. And they, even though these were originally boys' manga, technically, they had a lot of crossover female readers. Oh My Goddess was another example of kind of the love comedy manga that has kind of that kind of soft, yasashi, gentle feeling, which, you know, it's kind of new to American comics. Torrance Smith had so much trouble convincing Dark Horse to publish Oh My Goddess that he had to promise to cover all the losses himself if it was unsuccessful. It's actually still being published by Dark Horse today. It's still one of their most successful manga. Technically the first shoujo manga published in the U.S. By a major publisher was published by Viz. Matt Thorne, who is now a professor teaching manga theory in Japan, was originally a big shoujo manga fan, and he convinced Viz to release a couple of shoujo comics in a very limited edition back in the early 90s. Some of these like four shoujo stories are very, very hard to get a hold of now. But Viz hadn't really hit it off as a shoujo manga. It's possible because it's partly because Matt Thorne was more into like the classic shoujo manga, like They Were 11, the stuff from the 70s. It's also possible that it's because Sailor Moon hadn't come on TV yet. But there are some other shoujo that was published before Mixzine, like X-1999 by Clamp, or Magical Mates, which was published by Antarctic Press, which they never got to finish. They only published like the first five issues, unfortunately. But anyways, Mixzine had a couple other interesting things going for it, apart from the fact that they did shoujo manga. For one thing, they did not use the word manga. They preferred to refer to manga as motionless picture entertainment. They also had a very distinctive editorial style, which was the brainchild of Stu Levy, the CEO. So, to give you an example, we can read some of their editorial text here. What's up, mixers? Now that most of you who are lucky enough to be still be students are back in class for more education, whoops, did I spell that long? We here at Mix thought it would be kind of cool to give you even more drop-dead, slamming, jamming, tear-jerking, heart-yanking, funky butt content for you to take with you to class, because we know you'll be reading Mixing out of your desk instead of writing on the chalkboard. Gee, Stu, can you write any longer of a sentence? So that, yeah, so Mixing was a kind of interesting magazine. One of the other things about Mixing was the fact that it did not only publish shoujo manga, however, it also published a mixture of boys' manga and the men's manga Parasite, which was actually an extremely gory science fiction manga. This is running in the same issue that Sailor Moon first appeared. So there are some people who believe that this was a slight image problem for Mixing. Actually, Parasite is a really excellent manga. It's been published by Del Rey right now. But so some people thought the Mixing was kind of, had a few issues. I thought it was a pretty awesome magazine, actually. And I was working at Viz at the time. I was like, oh crap, Viz is in real trouble. This Mixing thing is going to kick Viz's ass. It didn't, actually. In fact, what had happened was that it split off into two magazines. One of them was Smile. And Smile started out as kind of a fashion magazine, and then it turned into a shoujo manga magazine. And also, Viz at the time decided to start doing some shoujo manga that was like, you know, kind of like the type Mixing was publishing. They published Animerica Extra, which was also a magazine that combined shoujo and shonen manga. And Dark Horse published Super Manga Blast, which, although it didn't technically have any shoujo manga, was also like a similar manga anthology magazine. It had Oh My Goddess in it. So there was this little war of the anthologies, and Mixing kind of went on for a couple of years, and then it changed its name to Tokyo Pop, which is the name by which the company is still known nowadays. And one of the other things that was happening in manga at the time was that for the first time some manga started to get published from right to left. Previously, of course, no one had ever dared publish manga from right to left because everyone thought that Americans would be repulsed by it like vampires from crosses. But one of the things was that a lot of Japanese artists really wanted their work to be published in the original format, and so some of them, like Yoshiyuki Sadamoto, the great author of the Neon Genesis Evangelion manga, you know, basically asked for their work to be published in this format, or they wouldn't let it be published in America. And Viz came up with a compromise. They were like, okay, we'll publish it in two versions. We'll publish it in, like, the unflopped and untranslated version, and we'll publish it in the standard Viz version where it is all flopped. And so he's like, okay, go ahead. But some artists just would not allow that to happen. Here's how it looks. Here's the two versions. But once some artists wouldn't go for that at all, one of them was Akira Toriyama, the creator of Dragon Ball. He would not allow a flopped version of his manga to be published. So, starting with Dragon Ball, Viz started publishing unflopped manga for the first time. Like, without any flopped version at all. But this was one of the first commercially available unflopped right-to-left manga. However, there was also a bunch of right-to-left manga that people were already discovering online at, like, Scanlation sites. Through Scanlation, people were starting to get into the whole idea of right-to-left manga. Because obviously, if you're doing a Scanlation, I mean, there's no need to, like, worry about, like, whether people in comic shops are going to buy it. And furthermore, it makes it a lot easier if you just don't translate the sound effects. That saves you, like, hours and hours of time. So, however, even though Scanlations were starting to become popular, there was something a lot bigger that was about to hit the manga world at that time. Yes.
Slide shows a giant
Pokemon.
Pikachu.
Pokemon was about to give birth to thousands and thousands of new fans of, like, manga and anime and, like, Japanese-y stuff in general.
Looking closer, there's a child climbing into Pokemon or out manga of the giant Pikachu balloon.
It had to be censored a lot. Misty was originally wearing a swimsuit in this scene, but the people at Nintendo objected, and so they had to keep drawing her swimsuit bigger and bigger until now she's wearing kind of a burkini here. But the Pokemon, the manga was translated by Viz, and the whole thing was a total hit, and it ended up selling over 1 million copies of the first issue and becoming the most popular manga ever published in America. And suddenly Viz had tons of money, and suddenly there was lots of like little kids who understood what it meant when you had a big sweat drop behind your head. 2002. Alright, so now suddenly all these Japanese companies have discovered that it is actually possible to publish manga in the US and make money. Not just like lunch money, but like actual money. And so suddenly, the publishers of this magazine, Weekly Comic Bunch, decided it would be a good idea to start a manga magazine in America. Comic Bunch was founded by a bunch of dudes who originally got started in Shonen Jump magazine, like Tsukasa Hojo, the creator of City Hunter, and Tetsu Ohara, the creator of Fist of the North Star. They basically broke off from Shonen Jump and formed a new magazine. And then they suddenly decided, like, we're going to publish our magazine in America, and we're going to totally make a ton of money. And so they announced the publication of this new magazine, Raijin Comics. Meanwhile, however, the editors from Shonen Jump basically got wind that this magazine was going to be published in America, which is published by, like, their former artists who now turned into their most bitter enemies. And so basically they decided that perhaps they would also publish a manga magazine in the U.S., perhaps just to piss off the people publishing Raijin Comics. This may just be a rumor, or this may be why it actually happened. So, I was the editor of Shonen Jump, and I can personally testify that it was a very intense rivalry. Actually, this guy and me are very good friends now. This is one of the main editors of Raijin Comics, who sent me this email in the early 2002, at the time when I was just starting to become the editor of Shonen Jump.
He was challenging Jason to a game of basketball.
Came out in 2002, and they were basically, like, these huge Japanese companies, like, basically decided to create magazines in America, which was, like, a much bigger deal than had ever happened before. And there was tons of cross-promotion and tons of publicity. That is that dude who sent the email. That's him with the afro up there, Sam Humphreys. There was another guy, there was a couple other people involved with this magazine, including Jonathan Tarbox, who for all I know might be in the audience. If he is, I wonder if he'll wave his hand so I don't say anything embarrassing about him. But yeah, I guess not. But anyways, yeah, so the most interesting-looking guy in the company was him, though, so that's why I have a photo of him. And meanwhile, so it was this massive war where Shonen Jump started to promote itself, and meanwhile, Raijin started to promote itself, and both of them came out in America. Raijin was, they were both right to left. And furthermore, Raijin was a weekly magazine, just like in Japan. But, so the result of this bloody battle, however, was that, basically, let's look at the stuff that was published by Raijin. Frankly, it's pretty old school looking. It's all like a bunch of square jawed, manly dudes, who are really awesome. But whereas nowadays, I mean, it's a question of just changing taste. You know, nowadays, manga that's popular tends to be in a more stylized, cartoony style. I don't have any examples here, but in a more like shoujo influenced, be shown in beautiful boy style, like, you know, Death Note. But the result was that, unfortunately, for various reasons, Raijin Comics went out of business horribly, and Shonen Jump survives to this day. So, maybe that was a cheap shot, but Raijin Comics was canceled, and Shonen Jump survived. And even though they, after defeating their rival, they decided that perhaps they would continue publishing the magazine and not just cancel it out of spite. So Shonen Jump continues. But meanwhile, something also bizarre was going on in early 2002. Tokyopop, which previously had published all their manga left to right, decided they would start publishing manga right to left. Not only that, but they would like make a big deal out of it. And they had the whole 100% authentic manga logo. And they pretty much were like, hey people, we're publishing manga right to left, because not just because, you know, the licensors want us to, but because it's awesome. They did ads like this, saying stuff like, what if Superman's logo on a Superman shirt was printed backwards? Wouldn't you hate it? And so they announced that they were going to do manga and right to left with Japanese sound effects. And so this caused a bunch of bitter debate. Whereas people like Torrance Smith, who had like been some of the earliest people in the manga industry and had like invented the whole idea of flopping manga, were like, why would you publish manga unflopped? Obviously, you know, English language readers will never be able to read unflopped manga because it's going to be a pain. And then, like, Sue Levy would be like, well, as a matter of fact, yes, people will read it unflopped, and they already are publishing unflopped manga in Europe, and what the heck, let's do it. So, yeah, partly it's because it's more authentic and because the artists want it that way. However, there's also another reason, possibly, which is that it's about one-tenth as cheap to produce unflopped manga with the sound effects untranslated.
A lettering costs $18 to $36 per page, whereas unflopped, $3 to $6 per page for lettering.
$16.95. And once you sell the manga cheaper, people will buy the manga, and now we get into like the economics lesson. Basically, everybody's happy, and suddenly manga starts really appearing in bookstores. And one of the people who was actually working at bookstores at the time, who was responsible for buying all this manga and deciding maybe manga can be popular, was Kurt Hassler, who was an early manga fan, and who ended up founding Yen Press a couple of years later. But he was really involved in like getting manga out there where people would see it in bookstores. And now we only have 5 years to go in about 10 minutes. All right, 2003, suddenly manga publishers are rising up all over the place. Like AD Vision, starting ADV manga. Or like Del Rey, who basically got all the licenses from Kodansha, one of the big Japanese licensors. And their chief editor was Dallas Midoff, who also has buttons named after him, which are down in the lower right-hand corner. That's not actually part of the cover of Tsubasa. And like CMX manga. Furthermore, we started to see manga published in America that no one ever thought would be published, like Boys Love Manga, also known as Yaoi Manga. There actually was some yaoi manga published back in like 2001 in the ebook format, but no one noticed it at all. It didn't become popular until 2004 when Digital Manga and CPM started publishing Boys Love Manga. And now, of course, everyone reads Boys Love Manga. I saw Barack Obama reading some. And yeah, so here we have the Boys Love Manga sample, which I included in this presentation for when I gave the presentation at like a library full of like people in their 70s, and so I could shock them all. Although I really should have picked more shocking pages. All right, so the manga market continued to grow and grow, and Viz now launched a new shoujo magazine in the U.S., Shoujo Beat, and also started publishing some manga that could technically be called Jose manga, women's manga. For older women, like Honey and Clover, which is sort of aimed at college students. Aurora Manga Publishing is the first manga publisher to really announce, we are going to publish like women's manga. And they have. They've published stuff like Walk and Butterfly, which is a pretty good Jose women's manga series. They're also the first people publishing Rinnai, a romance manga, which is basically like softcore porn romance manga with... It's kind of like imagine yaoi manga was one of the participants or places of girl, and you can, that's kind of what it's like. I know, it's hard to believe, but... and now manga artists, are commanding, like, massive crowds, like when Clamp came to Anime Expo in 2006, and just had, like, enormous audiences waiting for them. Gravitation EX was the first manga to be published simultaneously in the U.S. and Japan. Of course, Naruto is still like the best. For all this, Naruto is still the best-selling manga. However, OEL manga are also starting to take off in recent years. Some of the most popular and I think best artists are Svetlana Shmakova, who does DramaCon and is now doing a series in a Yen Plus magazine, and Felipe Smith, who did MBQ, which. Which is a very adult series about a struggling comic artist working at who isn't working at a burger joint. He doesn't get a job at the burger joint until the last volume. But an excellent series. American artists who draw in a manga style are even starting to get noticed in Japan. Like these American artists who won a manga competition in Morning 2 magazine in Japan. Bikuri and Rim. Their series Kagi no Matsuri, their one shot, was published in Morning 2 magazine. Another American winner was of a manga competition was Madeline Roska. She's Australian. But her OEL manga Hollow Fields won a award, which was given by the actual Japanese government for the official International Manga Award. And standing up there with her on the podium is Taro Aso, who is the leader of the Japan Foreign Ministry, which was dedicated to promoting Japanese culture abroad. And Taro Aso was famous because he was one of the first Japanese government officials to announce that he was an otaku who loved manga. In fact, due to his love of Rosen Maiden, he was known as Rosen Aso. However, if you look at his Wikipedia, he's also famous for some other controversial statements, such as that, as economics minister, he would make Japan a country where rich Jews would like to live. Or his controversial statements regarding the relationship between Japan and China, and Japan's World War II. Or World War II actions against when they colonized Taiwan and stuff like that. A controversial dude. And it's promoting Japanese pop culture. So yes, he's very into the whole idea of promoting Japanese pop culture abroad. But let us move on, because obviously Japanese pop culture is doing an awesome job of promoting itself, even without Taro Aso promoting it. And some American OEL artists have even achieved the awesomest award possible. Wrong slide again. All right, it's not merely Japanese comics which are becoming popular in America, but also Korean manga, which is very very similar to Japanese manga in a lot of ways. And some American artists, a very small number, even received that ultimate compliment of actually being published in Japan, like Felipe Smith here, the creator of MBQ, who just recently, in the last 2 months, started Pipochu, his series in Morning 2 magazine in Japan. And he's now living in Japan and doing every American artist's dream of getting a series published in a Japanese magazine. The series is about a kid who's from Chicago's South Side. And in order to live on the streets, he has to pretend to be like a gangster. But in fact, he really loves Pikachu, and he's really a complete nerd. And he wins a trip to Japan, where he meets a bunch of yakuza. 2008. All right. So obviously, manga is unbelievably popular now. There's manga everywhere. There are gazillions of manga publishers. Even though Naruto is still the number one manga in terms of sales. But manga has some controversies and problems. Manga censorship is possibly on the rise because, of course, now manga is extremely visible and, you can get it anywhere. So you might, if you have a troublesome manga, you might decide to, for instance, cover up the panty shot by raising the logo so that it covers it. Or if you have a manga named 666 Satan, you might rename it the Oparts Hunter. If you have a character being attacked by a giant pair of testicles, you might change those testicles into a stomach, which is much less offensive, like in the scene in Shaman King. Or if you have kids smoking, smoking is obviously bad. If you can't have kids smoking in a comic in America, even if they're bad kids, so. You might, in the scene in The Car No Go, change a cigarette to gum, where the dude puts out his gum on the go table. But strangely enough, no matter how much really obscene and dirty stuff there is in erotic manga or boys love manga, it seems that it's possible to avoid getting controversy. When Scholastic pulled Shonen Jump magazine because of this scene where. The dude in Yu Yu Hakusho uses the cigarette to identify his opponent in the dark in a pitch black cage match. Or the fact of Peach Girl having a rape scene in it, which is all seen in comics and libraries, shock parents. Or the fact that you can see a guy's butt in Absolute Boyfriend, which means that an Absolute Boyfriend is an adult graphic novel. And so the whole bookstore had to freak out and move the graphic novel and everything. So it seemed like it's impossible to avoid controversy. And so the manga publishers are still trucking along, and some of them are censoring manga and others aren't. Meanwhile, the manga actually might offend people. It's still getting published in the U.S. At least some of it is. Some of the really hardcore, non-consensual boys love manga, like Love is Like a Hurricane, I think that might be a little more. I think you might be a little more freaked out by that than Peace Girl, but you know. But for some reason, parents aren't noticing this kind of stuff. Or Nymphette, the pseudo lolicon manga about like the 27-year-old teacher, I believe, and the like, I think 10-year-old student, which actually was not published in America. The Seven Seas decided not to publish it at the last minute, just you know, just because. So, anyways, but is manga? I mean. Is manga going to continue to be successful? Well, there's some people who, you know, think that the manga market is just a bubble and it's going to crash. One of the people who's really said some bad things about manga recently is Al Khan, CEO of 4Kids Entertainment, which is the which was a major license holder for some of the big shows like Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pokemon. And recently in 2006 he said, oh, it'll never be a big deal here because kids in America just don't read. Let's go a year into the future, like, and see if Al Khan had a better opinion of manga. I think basically it's over in Japan for the moment. I think Japan is tired. I think manga is tired. In your own little world, it might be great, but in the real world, it's not working. So, anyways, it might be for reasons like this that the first Google hit that comes up on Al Khan is a petition on how to kill him. I don't know. I've never met him myself. But anyways, and they're not even talking about this stuff that he says about manga. They're just complaining about the character names in Yu-Gi-Oh. But so the manga industry has had some ups and downs recently. Like with Tokyopop firing a bunch of people. Tokyopop, you know, who was a big influence in terms of publishing shoujo manga and also publishing manga right to left for the first time. But for those people who think that the manga market has reached its peak, I would like to close with the words of the always wise Carl Gustav Horn, pictured here with the creator of Lone Wolf and Cub, who always told me once, the vast majority of Americans have never read a manga. So theoretically, it would always be possible to get those many people who are out there reading, like, you know, who are out there reading stuff which is not manga, like your parents or, you know, the average person on the street, you know, to read manga like they sometimes do in Japan. The manga market can still grow, and who knows, maybe in like 5 years, the people who are now reading Naruto will suddenly decide they want to read like Section Chief Kosaku Shima about like the greatest businessman in the world, or perhaps Happy Mania, or perhaps, you know, any number of other awesome and bizarre manga which don't get as much attention in the U.S. So, anyway, so this is how, you know, this little look at the last 45 years of manga. Now we go back to our scene of Borders books. Actually, this is my room. So I make it my personal goal to read every single manga published in the U.S., like I did for my book. And I'm still struggling away at it. I'm going to continue to try to keep track of this manga world for the next 10 or 20 years. I hope you all are also there reading manga with me. And I hope you all enjoyed this presentation, and thank you for coming here. Great seeing you all. Feel free to come up and talk to me, and otherwise, I hope you have a nice dinner.
そして時は動き出す。